Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Steve Ember. But first, this report with help from Kelly Jean Kelly. The college years in the United States are a time for students to experiment. Many U.S. colleges and universities urge their students to explore a variety of ideas, interests, and even ways of thinking that may be different or new to them. Most Americans who go to college usually do so right after high school, when they are away from home for the first time. John Schulenberg believes that because of this separation from family members, some of the experimentation done on college campuses is not healthy. Schulenberg is a research professor at the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan. He notes that for years, drug and alcohol use by students has been a big issue at U.S. colleges and universities. Many movies and television shows present drug and alcohol use as just a normal part of the college experience. Yet Schulenberg told VOA that it has a lasting effect on students' overall well-being. The fact is, the brain is still growing through the mid-20s, he said.
That is why Schulenberg is concerned about evidence of increasing use of the drug marijuana at U.S. colleges and universities. In July, he and a team of researchers published a study. It found that in 2018, marijuana use among college-aged Americans reached the highest level since 1983. The researchers examined the behavior of about 1,500 young people between the ages of 18 and 22 after their final year of high school. Almost 1,000 of these men and women were admitted to a college or university, while the rest were not. The study found that about 43% of those questioned reported using marijuana sometime during the past year. About 25% reported using it sometime within the past month. Earlier research has suggested links between heavy marijuana use and poor academic performance and mental health issues. But Schulenberg worries more about another finding of the new study. It shows that the number of people vaping marijuana doubled between 2017 and 2018. They use an electronic device, such as an e-cigarette, to combine water vapor with marijuana. The vapor contains tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, a chemical found naturally in the cannabis plant. Schulenberg says he has never before seen any form of drug use double in just 1 year. The New York Times reports that vaping has been tied to nearly 800 cases of lung disease and at least 14 deaths nationwide. The newspaper also reported that police have arrested producers of thousands of illegal THC vaping devices in three states.
Dalyn Wilcox says there are several reasons why both marijuana use in general and vaping are on the rise among young people. She is co-chair of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Other Drugs Coalition for the American College Health Association. For one thing, she says, a growing number of states have eased their rules banning marijuana use. This has resulted, in part, from efforts of the marijuana industry to spread the belief that the drug has medical uses. The immediate intoxicating effect of alcohol, as well as the dangers of its overuse, are also clearer than that of marijuana, Wilcox says. So many young people believe that using marijuana is safer than drinking beer or other forms of alcohol. Schulenberg agrees that more people see marijuana as safe to use. He noted that in 2018, only 22% of 19 to 22-year-olds said using marijuana can be harmful, either physically or psychologically. In 1995, 75% of young people felt that way. And some researchers are looking at ways in which marijuana may help people who are dependent on other, more dangerous drugs. However, both Schulenberg and Wilcox agree that the science supporting these claims is lacking, as marijuana remains illegal on the national level. So the study of both its possible helpful and harmful qualities is greatly limited.
Wilcox adds that young people are less concerned about the health effects of vaping for the same reasons they are less concerned about marijuana. Some companies have advertised vaporized nicotine products as a healthy alternative to smoking traditional cigarettes. They also offer products that taste like fruit or create a pleasant smell. But Wilcox argues there is hope for the fight to reduce these unhealthy behaviors at U.S. colleges and universities. She says research shows that school policies barring use of drugs and alcohol have been successful. And when it comes to alcohol, heavy drinking among college students has been decreasing in recent years. So there are signs students are more interested in healthy living. The longer we can delay the use, the better off we're going to be as a society, said Wilcox. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Hello, and welcome to Words and Their Stories. Each week, we tell the story of English language words and expressions, some old and others new. Today, we talk about a proverb often used in American English. A proverb is a short, well-known saying that offers a piece of advice. Our example of a proverb takes us to a farm, a chicken farm to be exact. Our explanation is part science, part folklore. First, the science. You probably know that chickens come from eggs. A female chicken, or hen, lays eggs, and then they hatch into chicks. Well, not all of them. Some eggs do not have a baby bird. So at our farm, a hen produces 15 eggs. If the farmer counts the eggs, she might expect to have 15 chicks once the eggs are hatched. But then 5 of those eggs do not hatch. Her expectations were not met, so she feels disappointed. She tells her friend how sad she feels. The friend may say to her, "Well, don't count your chickens before they hatch." Another way of saying this proverb is, "Don't count your chickens until they are hatched." So this proverb means you should not depend on something that has yet to happen. It is unwise to make plans based on something that hasn't happened. Another meaning of this proverb is this: do not assume to have everything you want until you actually have it in your hands. Now let's talk about the folklore part of our explanation. "Don't count your chickens until they are hatched" is a very old saying. Language experts say it appears in different forms and in many different cultures. It is also used in Aesop's Fables, a collection of stories from between 1300 and 1400 years ago. The fable we are talking about is known as The Milkmaid and Her Pail. A long time ago, a young woman carried a bucket of milk on her head. As she walked, the milkmaid dreamed of a better life. She wanted to be rich. So she thought she could sell her milk and then use the money to buy chickens. With chickens, she could sell eggs and earn more money. With lots of money, the milkmaid could shake her head no to all the men in her village who wanted her hand in marriage. The young woman was so caught up in her thoughts that she actually shook her head no. This caused the pail of milk to fall from her head and crash to the ground. Along with it, her dreams of becoming rich and independent. When she told her mother what happened, her mother said, "My child, do not count your chickens before they are hatched." So that is the folklore from Aesop's Fables. Now let's hear how to use this expression in everyday speech. John and Samantha are friends. Both are looking for jobs. John just had a job interview the day before and cannot wait to tell Samantha all about it.
Samantha, how is your job search going?
It's going okay. I spoke with two potential employers last week, and I should hear something back soon. But for now, I'm still saving all the money I can from my part-time work. How about you?
I had a great interview yesterday. In fact, afterward, the woman I spoke with talked as if I was already her employee.
Wow, that's great news, John. Good for you.
Thanks. And the best thing, the pay is great. I'll be able to buy a townhouse. In fact, I have an appointment today to look at one right near my new job. And I'll have a full-time job and a new home in less than a month.
Wait a minute, John. Did you actually get something in writing from the company?
Well, not yet.
Did you actually sign a contract?
Well, no, but...
A little friendly advice, John. You don't officially have the job. So, try not to count your chickens before they hatch.
What do you mean? The job is a sure thing.
Nothing is guaranteed, John. So, you know, don't get your hopes up. That way, you won't be disappointed if things don't work out.
So, I should probably return the expensive clothes and briefcase I just bought for the job?
I think so. Maybe for right now.
Let's keep our fingers crossed for John. Hopefully, all his eggs will hatch, and he'll get that high-paying job. And that's all we have for you today. Join us again next week for another Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. President James Madison retired after 8 years in office. His Republican Party chose another Virginian, James Monroe, as its next presidential candidate. The opposition Federalist Party had almost disappeared by the time of the election in 1816. James Monroe easily won the election, but not everyone was happy with the result. After all, Monroe was the fourth president from the state of Virginia. The situation caused hard feelings among political leaders in other areas, especially the states of New England. Monroe sought to improve this situation. He wanted to give the top four jobs in his cabinet to men from each of the nation's four major areas: the Northeast, the South, the West, and the Middle Atlantic coast. But he could find no Westerner who would take the job as head of the War Department. So he had cabinet ministers from only three of the four areas. The West was not represented. Despite the political concerns, most Americans liked Monroe and welcomed his presidency. Historian Harlow Giles Unger has written more than 20 books, including one about James Monroe. Mr. Unger says Monroe was one of America's most beloved presidents. He had been Secretary of State and Secretary of War at the same time under President Madison. He had also been a diplomat under President Thomas Jefferson and helped carry out the Louisiana Purchase, which doubled the size of the country. And Monroe had fought in the Revolutionary War and in the War of 1812.
So Monroe came out of the War of 1812 as a hero, and he and his wife, his beautiful wife Elizabeth, moved into what was a blackened hulk of a presidential mansion. And workers slathered on these thick coats of white paint, and really so thick that it gleamed white.
Harlow Unger says the new president sought to improve the country's safety. Monroe wanted to prevent any more invasions and to extend the country's natural defenses. One of the first problems he faced was in East Florida, in land which is now part of the state of Florida. The area borders the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico. At that time, East Florida belonged to Spain, but Spain controlled only a few towns in the area. The rest was controlled by criminals, escaped slaves, and former British soldiers. The area was also home to Native American Indians of the Seminole and Creek tribes. Sometimes people from East Florida would enter the state of Georgia and attack American citizens. One serious fight involved Seminole Indians and people just across the Georgia border. Monroe ordered General Andrew Jackson to march against the Indians. Jackson was a hero of the War of 1812 against Britain. He sent a message to President Monroe. It said, "Let me know in any way that the United States wants possession of the Florida Territory, and in 60 days it will be done." Jackson received no answer to his letter. He believed the silence meant that he was free to seize Florida. He quickly gathered a force of soldiers and marched toward Florida. General Jackson failed to capture any Indians, but he seized two Spanish towns, St. Marks and Pensacola.
he also arrested two British subjects. The two men were tried by a military court. They were found guilty of spying and giving guns to the Indians. Both were executed. President Monroe called a cabinet meeting as soon as he learned of Jackson's actions. All the ministers, except Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, believed that Jackson had gone too far, but they decided not to denounce him in public. Secretary Adams prepared messages to Britain and Spain about the incidents. His message to Britain carefully stated the activities of the two British subjects in Florida and explained why they were executed. Britain agreed not to take any action. Adams' message to Spain explained the situation this way. Spain had failed to keep the peace along the border as it had promised to do in a treaty. The United States had sent soldiers into Florida only to defend its citizens on the American side. The United States recognized that Florida belonged to Spain, but if Americans were forced to enter Florida again in self-defense, the United States might not return the territory to Spain. Spain had a choice. It could send enough soldiers to keep order in Florida, or it could give Florida to the United States. Spain really had no choice. At that time, Spain's colonies in South America were rebelling. All had declared their independence. José de San Martín led the struggle in Argentina. Bernardo O'Higgins was in Chile. And Simón Bolívar created the Republic of Great Colombia in the north. Spain's forces could not be sent to Florida. They were needed in South America. So the King of Spain agreed to give Florida to the United States. In exchange, the United States agreed to pay $5 million to American citizens who had damage claims against Spain. Historian Harlow Unger says the negotiations with Spain led to more than just Florida. He says President Monroe and Spanish officials also agreed on the boundaries of the Louisiana Purchase. They set the boundaries on the very top of the Rocky Mountains in the central west of the United States. The mountains created a natural border. Mr. Unger says they extended American territory into the northwest edge of the continent to what are now the states of Washington and Oregon. In other words, he says, Monroe moved the American frontier to the Pacific Ocean.
He really stretched the nation into an empire that reached from sea to shining sea.
With the new growth of the nation, tens of thousands of people began moving west. They built houses, started farms, and created towns.
And it was the first time in world history, really, that any sovereign state had granted so much land to people that were not of noble birth. And this expanded the strength of the American population. For the first time now, thousands, tens of thousands of Americans became landowners. With the ownership of land, these people were now, Americans, thousands of them, were now able to vote for the first time, were able to run for office for the first time, and really direct the course of their communities and their nations. It empowered the American people, and they absolutely worshipped Monroe for his efforts.
Her- Harlo Unger says that with the strength and unity of the American people behind him, Monroe could make an important decision about international relations. The issue was the rebelling Spanish colonies in South America. The King of Spain did not want the United States to recognize the colonies' independence, and Spain asked European countries to help it put down the rebellions. Britain wanted no part of the Spanish proposal. It was trading heavily with these new Latin American countries. Spanish or even French control of this area would destroy or limit this trade. So Britain proposed a joint statement with the United States to say that neither country wanted any of Spain's territory in the New World. Britain also wanted the United States to join in opposing the handover of any of Spain's American territories to any other power in Europe. Most of President Monroe's advisors urged him to accept the British offer. Secretary of State Adams opposed it. He did not believe the United States should tie itself to any European power, even Britain. Monroe accepted the advice of his Secretary of State. He included Adams' ideas in his message to Congress in December 1823. This part of the message became known as the Monroe Doctrine. The president said no European power should, in the future, try to establish a colony anywhere in the Americas. He said the political system of the European powers was very different from that of the Americas. Monroe said any attempt to extend this European system to any of the Americas would threaten the peace and safety of the United States. The president also said the United States had not interfered with the colonies of any European power in South America and would not do so in the future. But Monroe added, a number of these former colonies had become independent countries, and the United States had recognized their independence. We would see it as an unfriendly act, he said, for any European power to try to oppress or control these new American countries in any way. At the same time, Monroe said, the United States never had and never would take part in any war among the European powers. This statement by Monroe was only part of a presidential message to Congress, but it clearly stated one of the most important of America's foreign policies. The country was enjoying a time of good feelings under Monroe, but an old problem was about to return and divide the country again. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.